Welcome to another episode of Don't Call It a Rebuild, It's a Team Build, the podcast where we discuss various aspects of building a successful, sustainable baseball team, particularly as it regards to the Tigers. Before we get started, I just want to remind everybody that you can find our shows on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, anywhere where you get your podcasts. And as always, ratings and reviews are terrific. And you can follow the Tigers Minor League Report on Twitter at TigersMLReport, or you can follow this show, the Don't Call It a Rebuild show, at TMLRPOD, and like us on the Facebook page for Tigers Minor League Report. My name is Chris Brown. I'm kind of the host today, although I'm going to step back a little bit. And with me tonight is podcast founder and sports gadfly, Mark Gorosh. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. And how about yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you. And also joining us is National Scouting Supervisor for Perfect Game USA, Brian Sikowski. Brian, good to talk to you again.
You too, Chris. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And also with us is public analyst and author, Harris Frommer. Is it Frommer? I'm sorry, Harris. How do I pronounce your last name?
Either one is good.
All right. Well, sounds good. So, yeah, we got three really knowledgeable guys here. And tonight we're really going to be focusing on one particular aspect of team building, and that's the draft. And with that, I am handing it over to you, Mark, to do your thing.
Well, it's 2020. It's a new year. It's time to do some 2020 podcasts, and I thought it would be a great way to kick off the new year by discussing the 47-win Tigers are going to be drafting number one in the Major League Draft this June. I don't think it's a big mystery that there are three potential candidates before we start the collegiate season, and I wanted to talk to some of the most knowledgeable people about amateur baseball players, both high school and collegiate, and what their opinions were of the draft in general, and specifically the three most prominent potential choices. And, you know, that would be Spencer Torkelson, Austin Martin, and Emerson Hancock. I would say that it's always a mistake before the season starts to try to to marry the idea of who's going to be the first pick too much, although I would say that at this point in time, Austin Martin seems to be the odds-on favorite. But I wanted to throw, Harris, you're a amateur public analyst pertaining to the draft, and obviously, Brian, you've watched a lot of these guys for 5 or 6 years now. Bryce, since you're, PG scouting director, give me your thoughts on the three of them, and where do you think, who do you think's the odds-on favorite, and who do you think's the best fit for the Tigers at this point?
Well, it's kind of too early to name a favorite. Like, none of these guys is Adley Rutschman like last year, where it was kind of wire to wire, this guy's going to go first. But we've had Martin from Vanderbilt number one since we did a 2020 draft list right after the 2019 draft was over with, and that's nothing that he did this fall or nothing that he did over the summer did anything to dissuade us from that. It's Alex Bregman comp type of player. He's going to play center field for Vanderbilt this year, which is what we heard. I'm not sure, it's not like they've announced that, but that's kind of where he was playing in the fall. That's kind of what the plan is supposedly moving forward for them in Nashville, is to play him in center. And that kind of speaks to his versatility. He can play center. He's a good enough athlete to do so. He can play shortstop. He can play second base. He can play third base. He can do all those things. And it's just, the best hitter in college baseball. It's hit 4-something last year with more walks and strikeouts, obviously playing in the SEC, doing it against the best pitching in college baseball every weekend. And there's no reason to think that he shouldn't be a Golden Spikes type of guy this year in college baseball. That's our guy. That's who I'd take right now on, January 15th. But we'll see in 5 months if that's true. And then, the next two are Torkelson and Hancock. Both are definitely more traditional Tigers picks than Austin Martin would be. Torkelson is the big physical right-handed hitting first baseman, not too dissimilar from Andrew Vaughn of last year, even though they're very different players. Vaughn was more hit over power. Torkelson's more power over hit. He's going to end up with some college baseball records, especially in the BB Corps era for home runs. It's a lot of bombs. It's silly juice. It's 70 raw, no question. But he's limited to first base. He's not all that good there to begin with defensively. He's a right-handed hitter, and, you don't find many scouts who think it's a plus hit tool. So there's some risk there. And Hancock could very well be number one. The reason we didn't have him number one was, he was kind of shut down a little bit over the summer. There was some reports of some soreness and various type things in the fall. So we were being a little hesitant on putting him at one. But when he's going, it's three pluses or better with like an ideal pitcher's body. And he's throws a lot of innings, and he goes deep in games, and it's kind of everything you want to see from a high-end draft prospect on the mound. If he comes out healthy and he's blowing people's doors off like we kind of expect him to, then there's every chance that he might end up being the slam dunk number one type of guy. I'm not taking that away from him. But for now, we rolled with Martin at one. And unless Hancock comes out looking like Mize did a couple of years ago in college, then it would probably still be Martin for us as we work towards June.
Hey, Harris, you do a pretty strong study of all these guys. What's your thoughts on these three guys?
You know, it's funny you ask because, you know, first of all, I'll just say I agree with both you and Brian. You know, it's very tough to pin the 1-1 moniker on a guy, you know, a month before the college season starts. That said, you know, it's interesting. I actually am probably the high man on Torkelson and, relatively speaking, the low man on Martin. So full disclosure, I will be going to I plan to go to Arizona middle of February, so exactly 1 month from now, to see the opening tournament that will kick off the college season mid-February. I think it's President's Day weekend, where I expect to see both Martin and Torkelson, as Vanderbilt and ASU will be playing in those games. So I haven't seen them yet. I haven't seen them in person yet. I've seen plenty of video of them, and I've spoken to scouts on them. Let's start with Torkelson first. The scouts I've spoken with on Torkelson have a higher opinion on him than Brian does, with all due respect to Brian. They say they actually laud his athleticism. You know, first of all, let me back up a second. The comparison between Torkelson and Vaughn is a very common one, you know, for a variety of reasons. Both Pac-12 guys. They played, you know, right-handed hitters, first basemen. I believe they're also from the same region in Northern California. That said, I'm not sure if that's a very accurate comparison. Torkelson's got a much more athletic build than Vaughn. He's 3 or 4 inches taller than Vaughn. He runs much better. And a lot of people don't realize this. Torkelson was actually, he played on the left side of the infield in high school, and he was a celebrated football player in high school as well. I believe he was a linebacker, although I'm not sure. Excuse me. That said, if you look at his, again, I agree with Brian in that he's got at least 70 power. And from what I've heard, here's where some of the differences lie. Some scouts have told me that they like his hit tool, and they view him as a guy, because of his athleticism, as a guy who could play corner outfield. And I haven't spoken to these scouts, but I've heard secondhand that there are some scouts who think he can even play third base at the next level. So I found that pretty interesting. And again, I'll be seeing him in a month, so I'll be able to see that all with my own eyes. In terms of Martin, I've heard the Bregman comparisons. I think those may be a little rich. You know, Martin's got a much different, although he's, you know, short, he's probably 5'10 or 5'11. He's got a much different build than Bregman. Bregman's a lot more muscular, a lot more broad throughout the shoulders. I'm not sure Martin will ever develop the power that Bregman has. You hear a lot, you know, people comparing Martin a lot to Bregman and to Dansby Swanson, the former Vanderbilt shortstop. Maybe that latter comparison is because of the fact, you know, that they attended the same school. But, I believe that Martin doesn't have his glove, and he probably doesn't have Bregman's power. And, he might play shortstop occasionally. I don't know if he'll be there full-time, especially, as a major leaguer. The bar is just so high at that position. My guess is he's probably a second baseman. And how comfortable are you drafting a second baseman 1-1, regardless of the hit tool? I mean, Keston Hiura, the Brewers, I mean, his hit tool was undisputed at the time of the draft several years ago, and yet, you know, he fell, he was drafted a little later than 1-1. In terms of Hancock, basically, I echo everything Brian has said. Physical specimen, big kid, still room to grow and mature. Supersonic arm, phenomenal fastball, good secondary pitches. Has done a lot with his control and his command since, you know, matriculating at Georgia. I think health is an issue. I know he had, a lat issue in May of last year, May of 2019. So obviously, the big thing for him, like it was for Maya several years ago, will be coming out of the gate healthy. But in terms of talent, I mean, he, to me, in terms of just physicality and pure stuff, he may be the best guy to come out of the college ranks since Garrett Cole in 2011.
Pretty high praise, because I haven't heard that comparison, Harris, but...
No, I'm not comparing him to Garrett Cole,
yeah.
But I'm saying in terms of pure stuff, he may be the best since Garrett Cole to come out in 2011. I'm not saying he's going to be the next Garrett Cole, but in terms of pure... I mean, I can't think of a college... I mean, Mize had the command for sure and the control, but I'm not sure anyone since Cole has had Hancock's arm and just a combination of overall stuff.
Okay. But before we drop these guys, give me, are there any other players, collegiate or high school, that we need to be paying attention to that could pop up later that might be able to sneak into the mix of these three?
A couple guys, you know, one guy, another SEC arm, and I believe it's a guy the Tigers looked at. I believe it's a guy that the Tigers looked at 2 years ago when he was a high school senior. He's now a draft eligible sophomore. JT Ginn, big kid, has a big arm, and, you know, obviously an SEC pitcher. We know how much Tigers like those SEC pitchers. I think with a very good year this year, I'm not saying the Tigers will pick him, but I think they'll definitely look at him. And a high school kid who is really right now picked middle of the first, is slated to go middle of the first round, but I've heard great things about him, and he really came on last summer. I think Zach Veen, of all the high school hitters right now, has the most heel on him. I'm not saying he's going to go 1-1, and the Tigers might not even consider him, but I think he's got enough heel on him where if he continues on his current trajectory, he may sneak into the top 10 and possibly the Tigers. He may be, if the Tigers want to at least look at a high school bat, he may be the guy they look at.
Fry, nobody sees more high school baseball players than you. What's your thoughts on any high schoolers or any collegiate pop-ups?
Well, just to talk on Harris's point about Zach Veen, like, big Veen guy, stupid left-handed power. He's put on 15 or 20 pounds this offseason. He looks great. He's absolutely punishing baseballs. You know, obviously playing in Florida, they can play outside right now still. So it's in preseason stuff. He's putting on massive BP displays, and we know that BP is not anywhere close to translating. But, you know, to have that power and a left-handed swing and a great body, and he's a good athlete, it's kind of like Riley Green coming out in the sense of, like, you're not sure if he can play center field. Like, he might end up being too big. But, again, not really a huge concern right now, I don't think. But a guy to watch for sure. My guy in the prep class and the guy that we have ranked third overall on the draft board is Austin Hendrick. Left-handed hitter, corner outfielder. You know, if you wanted to tell me you're going to send him out in center field, like, sure, okay. He's a solid average runner. It's not a problem. It's just he's all bat. It's bat. It's left-handed bat. He was unreal at East Coast Pro in August, was hitting against the best pitchers in the country. That's what that event is. Consistent 105-plus exit velocities, putting balls out all over the field in BP, driving balls off walls to all fields in game. Just that's the guy for me right now, high school-wise. And, you know, on the college side, it's Nick Gonzalez has a lot of love right now, New Mexico State second baseman. His numbers are pretty inflated because of where he plays. So his college numbers wouldn't necessarily look too deeply into those because they are bonkers, but New Mexico State is a launching pad. So
like playing at Coors, right?
Yeah, you got to take that into consideration a little bit. But then he went and destroyed Cape Cod, which you hit on Cape Cod, you can probably hit, you know, in most cases. So he's a guy to watch. He's not as defensively versatile, nor is he as athletic as Austin Martin. He's kind of more set at second base, but he's probably got more juice than Martin. So you're looking at a true offensive second baseman with legitimate power there. And I think Martin's going to come into enough power to be fine. I don't think he's going to hit 40 bombs, but Gonzalez might be the guy who can hit 300 with 25. But again, strictly second baseman, right-handed hitter. And then there's a couple other guys that you're kind of waiting to see on. Mick Abel's a guy. He's probably the top prep right-hander right now, him or Jared Kelly, depending on your preference. Abel's the more long, willowy, projectable type, and Kelly is every bit of as physically mature as he should be. He kind of looks like Michael Fulmer, but it's loud stuff. It's up to 100 with flashes of a 70 changeup and a plus slider at times, and it's loud. And the kid who just reclassified, Nick Bitsko, is a guy to look at. He was a 2021 kid from the 2021 class forever, just reclassified a couple weeks ago. He'll enter the 2020 draft. And I saw him at East Coast Pro last summer as well, and he was 93, 96, up to 7 with a plus curveball. So a guy to watch. But, you know, I think that the top three is kind of where it's at right now, like we talked about to start the pod. But those are definitely some names to keep an eye on.
Okay, so let me interject a question here, because this is obviously from the Mark Gorosh perspective and opinion about things, but they need to start getting some guys to play baseball at Comerica Park here soon, because, you know, it's like building a house and never finishing it, and keep showing everyone pictures of it. Eventually, you gotta show fans a tangible product and not just keep promising all the time. So the Tigers have a dilemma in some respects. They have a pretty good understanding of when they're going to get these pitchers to Comerica, which I think all of them will at least get a look-see this summer. I would assume Paredes is going to get to Detroit at some point in time, barring any problems this summer. So you now have three collegiate players that are the most likely to be drafted 1-1. If one of these high school kids really, really looks good, how much of a dilemma does it create for the Avila front office? Because to be really honest with you, you know, there's only so much patience in the world. And if you are going to be responsible for drafting a guy that probably won't get to the majors until after you've been fired, it creates a dilemma for you. So explain to me, you know, if a high school player deserves to be considered at one, how much of a dilemma is there for this particular general manager about drafting him?
Well, I mean, you bring up a point about it needs to be on the field eventually. Like, I'm with you. But, you know, at the same time, you still have to take the best player. It's the first overall pick. You want to take the guy who's going to be the best impact for your franchise. And again, I don't think necessarily that a high school player in this particular class is that guy. Sitting right now on January 15th, I don't think that that's the case. I think there's a couple guys who might make an argument for that, but I think you're still going to be picking from a college guy at this point. And with the way that the slotting system has gone since they've kind of enacted it, that's kind of how it is now. Is there's these players go to college now, you know, with the exception of the very top of the top. The best players go to college, get even better, and then get taken first overall.
I'm gonna address the player development aspect of college here a little later in the pod, but it's also a good time to ask because Chris has written a few pieces about drafting, you know, at the top of the draft, drafting high school players, and there are certain positions that are more likely than not to have a degree of success over others. So, Chris, talk about a little. I want to go back and touch on this because I understand we want to draft the best player, but it isn't always how it ends up working out, and there are certain probabilities and likelihoods along with the scouting that have, over the last decade, shown, you know, certain degrees of success. Can you give me a little Chris Brown perspective on that?
Well, sure. So, generally speaking, and I think this is kind of goes without saying, that college players are safer than high school players. They're closer to the major leagues. Generally, they're older. They've seen better competition. So that's the main thing right there. But within each sort of phylum of college and high school, there are varying degrees of success. I found that there's like a long history of saying high school catchers are very risky.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, that's true, although, you know, Joe Maurer went 1-1 and ended up having a borderline Hall of Fame career, depending on who you believe in. But, there's never been a high school righty taken 1-1. There's only been, what, two high school lefties? There was Brian Taylor, who never made the majors, and there was Brady Aiken, who never made the majors.
And David Clyde.
Yeah. David Clyde, okay, yeah. So, and it seems like the trend in baseball right now is teams are shying away from high school pitching there in the top 10 or even the top 20. A lot of those guys seem to slip down in the compensation rounds or even second round. And the most successful position I found in terms of value and just most guys showing up and doing well was college third baseman. But it's, you know, you never know. It's one of those things where it's chicken or egg, where the guys, college third baseman who are drafted high are just so good that it's obvious, or if they just tend to get, you know, undervalued later. But, yeah, you know, generally speaking, the high school shortstops and outfielders are kind of risky. A lot of the shortstops end up playing outfield anyway. And
right.
High school left-handed pitching was extremely risky, but hugely rewarding when it worked out. The guys, the lefties who worked out were CeCe Sabathia, Clayton Kershaw, Madison Bumgarner, Cole Hamels. But then, you know, more than half of them didn't work out at all. Or like Tyler Matzik had basically half a season in the majors, I think, and he was considered one of the successes in that group. So it's fun to put the players in groups like that just to do studies, but you really, you know, you can't do that when you're evaluating all these players. You have to look at all the other stuff. But, yeah, the history kind of can guide us to the directions that the Tigers should probably look.
Okay, so I want to interject something because I think evaluating players is slightly different now than even it was 5 or 6 years ago. So let's add all the technology we have. We have exit velocity. We have edutronic cameras. We have so many different ways to understand what players' skill sets are really like, or more importantly, we have ways to interpret how they're doing things and help them improve how they are doing it and maybe reach their potential or diminish some of their flaws, whether they're swing flaws or mechanical pitching flaws or the way their level of consistency when they're releasing baseballs as pitchers. So when you're looking at these type of players now, you know, how much is the technology helping you formulate your decision on who you're taking and how close they are to their ceiling and exactly what you think you can do with them? Because there's nothing about players now in game that you cannot measure. So what are your thoughts on that, Bri?
Well, I mean, it's all going to go into it. I mean, every team has edutronic cameras that they send to every amateur player to get video of them. And you see those guys out more than area scouts sometimes now, just the guy with the big ass suitcase that's carrying the edutronic around. And I'm not smart enough analytically to break, you know, to look at edutronic cameras and the data that goes with it and say one way or another why X player is better than Y player. You know, mm-hmm. I'm still kind of operating on the eye test, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, it all goes into it. And these guys are getting data on these guys for years now. You know, the whole summer circuit before high school kids spring for the draft is measured like that. There were more edutronic cameras at East Coast Pro and at PG National than there were regular cameras. And it's all going to go into it, but I don't have the access to that data that to be able to like make a sweeping declaration about, well, X player is better than Y,
so,
et cetera.
But Bri, did Austin Martin play in perfect game events as a senior in high school?
Yeah, he did a little bit. He came to Jupiter, but before that, he was kind of an unknown. He wasn't at National. He wasn't on the other major, the area code, the East Coast Pro, this, that, the other thing. He came to Jupiter. At the time, he was committed to Jacksonville, and he's from Jacksonville, like was a hometown kid, and came to Jupiter and blew up, you know, was really, really good with the bat, playing shortstop for his travel club. I think it was the Padres scout team, if I remember right. And from that point on, he was a heavily followed guy. And Vanderbilt obviously swooped in and stole him, for lack of a better phrase.
Right.
But yeah, yeah.
What about Torkelson?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember him at all, actually. Let's see. I can quickly look up his PG profile here, but I don't think so. I don't remember seeing him in high school. That's not to say I didn't, but
as Harris said, I mean, I can remember JT Ginn. I can remember, you know, he was a pretty highly touted right-hand pitcher,
yep,
as a high schooler and decided to go to school, right?
Yeah, okay. So Torkelson came to the National Showcase, so he was on the radar. We had him ranked in the top 250 high school players. So, you know, obviously that's not representative of how good he is, similar to how Casey Mize was ranked by us, but was on the radar. Came to National, ran like a 7 flat 60, threw 80 miles an hour across the infield, had a 96 mile an hour exit velocity. We liked him offensively, but thought that his athleticism was more towards first base, and we didn't think he had the arm strength to play third base either. So if he was going to play a non-first base position, it was going to be second or maybe left field. But it seems he certainly found a home at first base.
He seems like he's grown a little bit too, huh?
Yeah, he was 6'1", 205 in high school, or listed. And right now I think Arizona State has him listed at right around there. I don't know if he's much bigger than that anymore. It's he just kind of like got stronger more so than he sprouted, I would say.
But
just remember, with Torkelson is quite young for his class. He didn't turn, his birthday is in late August, so he's a full year younger than a bunch of guys he played against who are in the same class. So it's conceivable that the fact that he's a year behind in terms of age, that he just needed, you know, the extra year to catch up and like Brian said, just, you know, gain strength.
Yeah,
ASU has him listed at 6'1", 220 now. So he hasn't gotten any taller since high school, but has filled out more physically.
So just because I can see it here on Fangraphs rankings for the 2020 draft, Torkelson is 6 months younger than Austin Martin, 4 months younger than Emerson Hancock, just as a matter of comparison. And so, yeah, and he's 4 months younger than Nick Gonzalez. So, yeah, he's young for the class. And Harris, remind me, I think Torkelson hit 25 bombs as a freshman at Arizona State, right?
He did, and you know, it's even more impressive. He did hit 10. He broke his Barry Bonds record that he broke, and I believe it was 23 home runs his sophomore year. He was overshadowed early in the year by Hunter Bishop, of course. And then what I think is most impressive about what Torkelson has done as a collegiate player actually occurred on the Cape in the summer between his freshman and sophomore year. Remember, he was still 18, and he put up crazy, crazy numbers that summer. Yeah, he hit 3 on the Cape, and only which was higher than what he hit at ASU during the regular season. And so I remember he did that when he was still 18.
You know, one of the things that's sorry to interject real quick, but it's very interesting about this, because this is kind of a mimicking, I assume, what would go on in the draft war room, where you've got a bunch of good players to choose from, and it's really hard to kind of differentiate, and there's sort of conflicting information that might be right on both accounts. So it's difficult. I suspect that one of these players will separate himself from the pack just through his performance this year in a good way. Maybe one will do it in a bad way as well. But to me, Torkelson may have the hardest path to do that. To separate himself, he might have to hit 400 with 30 home runs because he's already been so good for the first 2 years.
Okay. Well, the Tigers have 4 picks in the first 73. They have a total they strangely have a total lack of bats beyond Paredes and Green. The problem is they were very, very thin also in arms at both Lakeland, West Michigan, and Connecticut last year. So it seems like they're top-heavy in arms, but there's not nearly as much system depth with pitching beyond these top 5 arms as people might think. So, you know, give me an idea. They have 4 in the first 73. You know, going down within the first 100 guys, you know, each of you, and I'm sure, Chris, you may have a few too, who are some of your favorites that you think, you know, we should be watching for as a collegiate and, you know, amateur high school season, you know, rolls on, that the Tigers may have some interest in these first 73 picks?
Hey, just a second, before anybody chimes in, I want to take a quick break real quick. Sorry, leave you hanging there for our answers about who they should take later. Just a quick break. We'll be back in a second. And we're back here to Don't Call It a Rebuild, It's a Team Build. And we were just about to talk about some players we like a little bit later in the draft, because the Tigers do have 4 picks in the top 75. So I don't know who wants to go first, but have at it.
Harris, why don't you go first?
All right, can you hear me?
Yep.
Perfect. You know, it's so hard because, again, the season hasn't started yet, and you don't know how the Tigers board is going to look. But two guys, you know, given the relative dearth of bats in the Tigers system, you know, I'm looking at bats, and like you said earlier, Mark, you know, at some point you got to put the team together. You just can't show pictures of the house. But, you know, two guys I could see the Tigers taking. One of them, Jordan Westberg. He's at Mississippi State. Pretty physical shortstop, although, you know, given the size, it's possible he can move over to the third base. Again, Tigers love the SEC players. He's also a guy at 326 in the Cape and slugged 516 with a good number of extra base hits. So that's the first guy I could see being in play for them. And another guy is actually another ASU guy, Gage Workman, who again is even younger than Torkelson. Physical third baseman who's got room to grow. And because Alika Williams is the shortstop for ASU and is a very good defender, you know, he's pushed Workman to third, but a lot of people think Workman has a good shot of playing short as a pro. He put up very good numbers at ASU during his sophomore year, decent numbers on the Cape. But again, he's so young for his college class. You know, it is a good possibility that he could take off next year. He's also a switch hitter. So he's another possibility I could see the Tigers at least looking at for their second pick.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of guys. Like, I'm just looking at our board right now. And we actually have JT Ginn, who Harris mentioned earlier, right there at pick 38. Obviously, the fact that his velocity was so far down late spring last year, and I know he was a freshman who was in his first college season, and he probably had never thrown that many innings before, but he was 86-88 in the regional game or the super regional game, whichever one that was concerning. There have always been some kind of worries about his health and the durability there, and he's old. Like, in the vice versa of talking about younger guys for the grade, he's a draft-eligible sophomore because he's older than everybody else. But for bats, I mean, we have Aaron Sabato right around there, the first baseman from North Carolina, another draft-eligible sophomore who's old for the class, maybe the strongest kid in the class, although Michigan's Jordan Nwogu would have something to say about that. But a guy who might end up going ahead of that, because I think he's going to just destroy college baseball this year offensively. But a first baseman, limited to that, pretty physical dude, just stupid raw pop. He can bang. A lot of things to like there if we're trying to just put an influx of bats into the system. And there's Ryan Hagenow we have right around there. He's a high school right-hander. He's one of my favorites in the class. I'm sure you guys have seen me tweet incessantly about this kid because I really like watching him pitch. He's a Tennessee high school kid. He goes to Farragut High School in Knoxville, which is a perennial powerhouse. 6'5", 200, really lean, really projectable. It's easy. He doesn't throw all that hard yet, but I really don't even care. Most starts that I saw him, he'd touch a two or a three early and sit 88, 90, 88, 91. The slider's good already. The changeup's good already. He tunnels all three really well. He commands the zone. He's a guy that I like in that let's save a little bit of money at one and overpay later type of scenario. Not that they should or will do that, but just one of those types of kids that I like a lot. And then another pure bat is probably Daniel Cabrera from Louisiana State. Left-handed hitting corner outfielder, probably a left fielder, but it's just hit. It's not a real great athlete, going to have to play left field. He's not bad there. You know, he's not Kristen Stewart, but it's all bat. All he does is hit. And I just a guy that, as far as building teams go, you know, you want guys who can hit. And I think Cabrera can hit.
So. And where would a guy like Cabrera be slotted to go? Is he
we have him at 42. So, you know, right around there. Second round somewhere.
Okay. So, because 75 picks with compensation, that should take you to through the first two rounds, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and I will say, Mark, you brought it up, something that I've kind of considered with this draft. Just the Tigers, their system is top-heavy right now, and they need bats. So like you said, I could picture them doing something sort of the inverse they did when they took Mize first overall. So instead of take a college bat, either Martin or Torkelson at one, and then go with a high school pitcher there in the second round, probably pay them a little bit more. Because they're going to save a little bit of money up top no matter what, just because the slot for 1-1 is so high. So
right.
They might be able to overpay him a little bit. And, you know, they figured out a way to do that the last time. But, yeah, Brian mentioned one of the arms I really like, that Hagenow kid.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I love, you know, those big, tall, projectable high school pitchers. There's a kid named Will Sanders that intrigues me.
Mm.
And a lefty named Nick Griffin. Brian would know a lot more about these guys than I do. But they all – just the basic profile, kind of youngish, lanky, with interesting stuff right now and potential. I could see them going after somebody like that.
I have to ask this, and it's because I love Raj Castillo, so I'm going to ask about one player that I noticed in the rankings, and it just never seems like his bat came around, but give me 30 seconds on Nander DeSantis.
Nander was super famous in high school, went to TNXL Academy in Florida, you know, like a really high-end baseball institution that parades around as a school also. You know, he was good. And he still is good, but it somewhere along the line of like his senior year of high school, it fell off a little bit. He was a guy who we thought was slam dunk first rounder, like the summer before his senior year. And then into that fall and then into that spring, obviously, it wasn't great. Just was struggling to make consistent contact. The athleticism is still there. You know, we still think he plays shortstop. He's at Florida State now. He's a draft eligible sophomore. And there's still a lot of tools there, still a lot of things to like, but he's a guy who needs to perform this spring. And if he does, like, he's going to fly right back up. It's
right.
A similar situation to Brady McConnell last year at Florida. Guy was a superstar the summer after his junior year of high school. He was an All-American, did all the high-level events, was talked about as a potential first-rounder. I remember sitting and watching him at PG National, and Jeremy Brown, a guy I work with, was sitting next to me, literally texted Kevin O'Sullivan to say, hey, you're not going to get Brady O'Connell. Or Brady McConnell, pardon me. It was just kind of that like funny dynamic. And then had a really rough freshman year at Florida, was a draft eligible sophomore, came in lower on boards, like somewhere on day two, you know, just because he can play short, good athlete like that. And then he destroyed the baseball last year and went in the second round. And there's still some concerns about his swing and miss. And I know he didn't get off to a great start in pro ball, but it could be something like that where just – all of a sudden, the performance matches up to the tools, and we get back to the guy looking like a superstar, and he flies way back up the boards. It happens every year. So, yeah, it could very easily do that. Just right now, he's kind of down the board a little bit. We have him in right the sixth round.
Harris, you have any guys that are on the Harris-Frommer must watch list, and you may consider, you know, down the board a little bit?
Well, we talked about Veen already. There's one guy, and he's much, much higher on the board, but he's a guy I wish I would have mentioned earlier, and I'm eager to get Brian's take on Garrett Mitchell. Now, I know he was very heralded coming out of high school, I believe in California. He goes to UCLA. He didn't have the best freshman year, but he torched the baseball last year, especially towards the second half of the college season. You know, so I believe 70 runs, 70 arm, burgeoning power. But unfortunately, he's got type 2 diabetes. And I'm sure every team, and I'm obviously not a medical professional, so I'm certainly not qualified to talk about this. And I'm sure also that every team evaluates this or assesses, you know, the health condition differently. But he's a guy where if he didn't have diabetes, if he didn't have type 2 diabetes, I'm curious where he'd be on team's board. I'm just curious to hear what Brian's take on him is, because I've heard rave reviews, especially when it comes to his tools.
Yeah, the tools are off the charts. They always have been with him. He was in it. The physicality with the tools is something special, because he's every bit of, you know, 6'3", 200 or something like that, 6'2", 205, somewhere in there. He's not like a beanpole. He's a pretty physical kid. And it's just as you said, super loud tools. It's plus run, it's plus arm, you know, maybe a half tick higher or so in some cases. He's got raw power. His thing in high school was he never really consistently hit, and that's why he wasn't a first rounder out of high school, was he never really consistently barreled the baseball well. But the tools flashed. So, you know, he's kind of like a hope and pray kind of guy. And obviously last year at UCLA, that kind of came to fruition, where the offense started to come along and it started clicking, and their development staff there has done a really good job with him. He's cut down on some stuff. UCLA plays a very West Coast style of baseball, which is, you know, move runners and bunt and hit behind guys. And, you know, we don't sell out for home runs here and this, that, the other thing. But at the same time, they do a fantastic job of teaching guys to literally place barrel on ball better. So that's what's helped him. That was what was holding him back. And now, like, he's in the top 10 of our board. I think we have him at 10 exactly, or 11 right now. And it's that. It's a left-hand hitter. It's a center fielder. It's a physical guy who's loaded with tools. And if he blows up again this spring and continues to hit and hit for more power, he has every single ability like anybody else on this list to jump way up. Like, a guy like that could be like the Hunter Bishop of last year, where kind of always had tools, kind of always had physicality, was kind of always a freak, but never really quite put it together. And then he did and went in the top 10 overall of the draft. And Mitchell hits left-handed. So, you know, it's a lot of things to like there with him, for sure.
Fangraphs has him.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question for Brian. What happened in 2020 if Mitchell, you know, you mentioned Hunter Bishop, but I think Mitchell may even have a more complete tool set than Hunter Bishop. He surely has a better arm. He probably runs better. He might not have Bishop's power, but like you said, he is a physical specimen, and there is juice in the bat. I mean, what if he torches the Pac-12 this year? And you were sitting here on Memorial Day, and I mean, I'm just going to throw some numbers out at you. He's hitting .390, you know, with 19 home runs and 25 steals, and the tools match the numbers. Is he a guy, you know, the Tigers would consider? And again, I don't know how their medical staff would assess his physical, his type 2 diabetes, but I'm just curious if that scenario plays out. You know, what are we looking at for? Is he a guy the Tigers could consider?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the same kind of thing happened with Blade last year. All of a sudden, that dude hit 30 bombs. You know, he was on boards. He was in the second round or whatever it was coming into the season last year because he was a good athlete. He can play right field, and he always hit. But he never hit more than 4 or 5 bombs a year, whatever it was, at Vanderbilt. And then last year, he hit 30 or 26 or whatever it was, and bam, fourth overall. And the Tigers would have absolutely taken him at 5. So, yeah, I think you could absolutely see a similar thing with Mitchell. If he comes out and does, like you said, I know you were just spitting numbers out there, but if he hits 20 bombs this year and steals 25, 30 bases and consistently hits, and the strikeout rate isn't real high, and he walks like he's supposed to and continues to play a high-level center field, then there would be no reason for them not to consider him at 1. But in my mind, I don't know enough about medicine to comment on his diabetes and how that would impact the draft stock, or if it would at all. But, yeah, 100%.
It's a great player, but, you know, for that both of you have gone over pretty well. A lot of tools, and someone will have to watch. All right, got to ask this because the Tigers are going to still be terrible this year. So I'd be remiss if I did not ask you, what do you think about the 2021 draft? Compare and contrast it a little bit, at least from a depth standpoint, and who's at the top, to the 2020 draft because I would assume the Tigers will be picking top five again in 2021. So what do we have to look forward to?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be quite as good as a class in general, though that can change. You know, we still have a year plus before we can make proclamations about the class's depth. The high school class is a little bit lighter, for sure. I think we can say that. Might be a couple high school first-rounders from the state of Michigan, though. But anyways, the top of the draft is Kumar Rocker in 2021. Everybody knows who Kumar Rocker is. He'll stay that way until he doesn't, if he doesn't. You know, someone's going to have to grab that from him. But after that, it's you look at a guy like Judd Fabian, Florida center fielder, you know, just a bat, like we've talked about. Adrian Del Castillo from Miami, he's kind of limited in that he's probably a first baseman, but it's a left-handed hitter who torched college baseball as a freshman. And then the high school class is like Brady House is number one in the PG rankings for 2021. He's a two-way guy. I've seen him up to 97 on the mound with a pretty decent slider, but he's mostly a bat. He's a play shortstop now, but he's probably a third baseman. It's significant power. He was one of the few underclassmen who came to East Coast Pro and then hit an absolute bomb there, which, you know, easy way to jump on radars is to do that. Like I said, probably third baseman, right-handed hitter. And Christian Little is the top prep arm in that class. He's, Harris, if you wanted to look it up, he's super, super young for the grade. I think he could, like, conceivably be a 2023, like an older 2023, definitely a 2022. But he's a 21. Seen him a lot. Great body. Everything checks out. The mechanical profile is really good. He's already up to 94, 95, 6'4", 205, something like that. Good breaking ball, good changeup. All he does is throw strikes. He's just, you know, one of those freaks that we talk about.
Hey, Brian,
the top of the class. Yeah.
Give us a minute on Luke Lito and explain who he is.
Luke Lito, shortstop from Portage, Michigan, which is Kalamazoo, goes to Portage Central High School, which is perennially a pretty good program there. A left-handed hitting shortstop. He's been on, you know, the superstar radar for a while now. Still comfortably projected in the first round. It's, you know, guys out there are calling him the next Jeter, which isn't really fair because, you know, he might be better, but and he might not be as good. You know, it's kind of unfair to make those comparisons. But anyway, it's a really good athlete.
Same high school, correct?
No, Jeter went to
Kalamazoo Central, I thought, or something
like that. Kalamazoo Central. That's right. I'm sorry.
Yep. Same area. I remember there was an article written, like, the next Jeter out of the Kalamazoo paper, whatever it was. But, yeah, he's a really good athlete. It's a smooth, really smooth left-handed swing. He's got a lot of power into the opposite field gap already, which is not something you see from kids that age. The arm strength is there. He doesn't really pitch anymore, but once upon a time, he was a young kid up to 92, 93 with a good curveball. Yeah, it's got a lot of tools. We're still kind of figuring him out as we go, which is, you know, you can't really figure out a 16-year-old kid. But, yeah, got a lot of upside. Could be a first-round pick for sure.
Harris, you got anybody in 2021 that you've decided meets the Frommer criteria or no?
Well, you know, in terms of the 21 draft class, haven't really focused that much on the high school kids, though I have paid attention to the college players. And, you know, obviously Kumar Rocker right now, if the 2021 draft is tomorrow, he'd probably be number one. But, you know, there are a lot of interesting bats in the college class, particularly fielders.
I just want to bring up the fact that Harris Frommer, taking one for the team, has gone outside in his winter coat to try to get better reception so we don't lose him. So thank you, Harris. All right,
thank you. Sorry about that.
It's okay. So you were sharing with us that you have some collegiate bats in the 2021 draft that you do like.
That's right. It's an interesting class. So a couple of small school guys as well as guys, you know, who are the traditional powerhouses. In terms of the small school guys, there's Colton Cowser at Sam Houston State in Texas, who actually had a pretty very good freshman year. I believe he came in as a third baseman and ended up playing a lot of right field later on in the season. And then there's Ethan Wilson at South Alabama, who put up huge numbers. And South Alabama is a bigger baseball power than people would think. Over the years, there's been a good number of guys who ultimately had solid major careers that came out of there. And in terms of the, you know, both those guys, by the way, are left-handed hitters. And with the bigger, you know, more traditional powers, you've got Judd Fabian. We'll talk about Judd Fabian first. He and Robbie Martin at Florida State. But Judd Fabian had put up pedestrian numbers at Florida during his freshman year. He's actually young for this class. If I'm not mistaken, he matriculated a year early. but he put up big numbers. He put up pedestrian numbers as a freshman, but when he went to the Cape, he exploded. And as I was explaining to me a couple months ago, he had a huge fall with the Gators in fall ball. And he's going to be playing center field this year. He's got a weird profile, left-handed thrower, right-handed hitter. But if last summer at the Cape and fall ball is any indication, we could be looking at a guy who could go in the top 10 picks next year. And then I mentioned briefly Robbie Martin. Not the loudest tools, but his bat will definitely play. He put up pretty good numbers as a freshman at FSU, and big things are expected of him in the next 2 years. So those are four interesting guys. And obviously it's a class right now that's dominated by Kumar Rocker, you know, for good reason.
Okay. All right. So this doesn't run too long. I got a couple things quickly I wanna touch on. And I'm really curious, Bri, if you've started to notice any transition in the way things are scouted, because it's going to be a change that people need to be paying attention to, and that is with the advent of a robo strike zone, probably by 2023, the catching position is going to totally transform the way it's scouted. So you don't have to be as, you know, you don't have to have any framing skills whatsoever anymore. And really, from a defensive standpoint, you have to block and throw, but I see a sea change where catchers are going to be looked upon maybe in a similar vernacular that second basemen are now looked at now, which is the position went from smaller, less powerful, more well-rounded, you know, play to second base is now what, in many respects, what third base is now. And it's an offensive position. You don't need a ton of range with shifting. You're not covering a ton of ground. And I think some of the defense, and I also think that it's very likely with the transformation to using technology to call pitches between the catcher and the pitcher. And I think eventually, before 2025, you will have somebody in a booth calling pitches for everybody, sort of like an offensive coordinator calls plays to a quarterback with a headset on. So the catching position is going to totally change. How do you think it's going to affect how things are scouted, the kids that are going to play there, and, you know, the nature of how teams should start looking at that position, even in this year's draft? Bri, what do you got for me?
Well, I think that you're still going to put a premium on athleticism and arm strength behind the plate. You still got to block balls. You still have to be a magnet in that respect. You still have to be able to throw runners out. But, you know, as we're moving away from receiving being a valuable skill, like that's not going to be a make or break type of thing anymore like it has been. And I also think you're going to see a premium placed on catchers who can hit the ball out of the ballpark. You know, yeah. I don't care if you can receive, if you can hit 25 bombs, you know. So, yeah, you're going to see that change a little bit. And I also think that that's going to continue us down the path of let's not take high school catchers early. You know, let's not take a guy in the first round who's just a high school catcher, because we're not so worried about, you know, we're just worried about offense at that point, basically. And it's easier to take a college guy who has shown he can hit 20 bombs against good pitching and maybe isn't as good a defender as the 18-year-old kid you like. But at the same time, it's still a pretty physically demanding position. And we're going to, I think we're going to move away even further from taking high school guys. But the premium will be placed on power, both with the arm and with the bat, I think.
What about guys that play left field and first base? Now you're going to have to, do you think as the requirements of the position start evolving along the lines we just discussed, that some kids that are less athletic, that, you know, there's value in catching? And you think that in the nature of the game, some of those kids may, in fact, find themselves being converted a little bit more to the position now that the requirements defensively may change?
Yeah, I think so. I think more and more advisors and agents are going to be open to that concept, because now it's like you talk about moving a kid behind the plate, you're talking about crushing his draft value as far as a high school kid goes. So no one does it. The advisors won't let them do it. It happens a little bit more in college. It happens in JUCO, but, you know, the high school kids, it just doesn't happen. As opposed to in the future, when we're talking about converting guys, and especially guys who have been on a college campus for a year or so, and they're hitting and they're a DH or something like that, and we need to find a way to get him in the lineup more, and we need to find a way to up his draft stock, and we stick him behind the plate, and who cares if he can actually receive the ball? Can he stand and throw it? Can he move laterally enough to block it? Can he still hit? Cool, let's do it. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think you could see that.
Okay. All right. Last, and you know, I'm asking both Harris and Brian this question because you both talk to a lot of scouts. There's a lot of conversations that are had while you sit on bleachers and, you know, behind fences and watch players play. There's a lot of dead time. So I know my opinion of the Detroit Tigers drafting philosophy and drafting acumen, but share with me as you talk to a lot of people around baseball in the scouting profession, you know, what's the perception in, you know, around baseball of exactly what the Tigers are doing? Am I being unnecessarily harsh on them, or do a lot of people shrug their shoulders sometimes? And, you know, it's pretty easy to pick a decent player when you're picking, you know, 1-1, 1-2, 1-3. I guess, you know, a lot of teams have missed on that, but you shouldn't in this day and age with all the data you can generate. There's no excuse when you're tanking to miss on a player like that. But tell me what, if anything, you know, what the perception around baseball is of, you know, the Tigers player development and drafting acumen.
Well, as far as drafting goes, like strictly within scouting, strictly within traditional scouting, to even further narrow the scope, it's not like as critiqued, because it's, you know, you can understand kind of why they take the guys they do from that perspective. But, you know, you can, Ray Rivera was universally mocked, but that was just one. Other than that, it's, you start talking to analytics guys or the scouting coordinator types who have their toes in both analytics and traditional scouting. And that's when you start to get to the whole, like, well, what are they doing? You know, or, and you talk, especially player dev guys, that's probably number one as far as like critiques of the Tigers is player dev guys across baseball. And I don't know if Harris, I'm sure, might have some different perspectives on that, because I don't talk to a lot of player dev guys, but the ones that I do are kind of like, you know, they're stuck in the 80s still, and they're trying to work their way out of it, and they're giving them credit for that, but they're still X amount of years behind the eight ball in that respect. And so the next 5 years are going to be really, really telling about what they've done with their
player dev. They also have a new player, you know, new head of player development, don't they, Chris? I mean, I think Graham's the head of player development now, right?
Yeah, I believe so. He was the hitting instructor in Milwaukee. Now he's the head of player development. Right. They moved Dave Owen over to the minor league hitting coordinator, I think. And they have a new pitching kind of head of pitching development as well, as in the guy from USC whose name escapes me right now. But
is that the eighth or ninth?
I think it's Hubs.
Yeah. Dan Hubs. Yeah.
Yeah, and Brian, you have some familiarity with Dan Hubs, right?
Yeah, he was, you know, like, I don't know him personally necessarily. We've met a couple times on the recruiting trail, but he's a guy who really adopted the driveline stuff, got in with Kyle Boddy, was kind of, I don't know what the phrase is, like a Kyle Boddy disciple, I guess.
And there's nothing wrong with being a Kyle Boddy disciple these days.
Absolutely not. Lord knows we are at St. Mary's. Big driveline people there. But anyways, yeah, he's adopted those philosophies. That's the pitching mantra that he believes in. I believe that that's what he's going to sort of indoctrinate the Tiger system into, along with some Alan Jager concepts, which everybody should anyways, I think. But so it's a positive, I think. I think that was a positive hire.
And let's add in, and I think you can speak to this a little bit, B, but, you know, Casey Mize is a huge, huge, huge disciple of pitch design, cameras. He's about as committed to new age pitching techniques and technology as, you know, Detroit maybe has ever had in a player. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, for sure. And there was and this is right after Mize got drafted, the Alan Jager and Kyle Boddy put out like a collective report that was like, it was sort of like an analysis of the 30 major league teams and their various pitching philosophies and player development systems throughout the minors, and like ranking them sort of as far as like these are the most player friendly and these are the most archaic. And there was a comment on the Tigers one that was like, with the exception of a very recent, very high round draft pick, like obviously talking about Casey Mize, like who they kind of leave alone and let him do what he wants to do, they're still stuck in the blank period. And I think that that's changed. But credit to the Tigers to just letting him do what he wants to do in that respect. But yes, so yeah, Mize definitely ahead of the curve there.
And Brian, you know, hey Chris, I know you can speak to this a little bit. Mize has rubbed off, from what we hear, quite a bit on Manning, Fado, Scoobal, and other people at Erie, all the time they spent together, all those guys that threw with them at Erie have all adopted a lot more technology-friendly perspective and have been trying to tweak their games using the technology. So with the addition of Hubs as, you know, minor league pitching coordinator, it might be a good fit for the system altogether, which is difficult for me to be saying nice things, but
yeah, well, and something that they pointed out in the MVP machine is that you see a lot of major leaguers doing this now, and the guys in the minors, they want to be major leaguers, so they want to do what the major leaguers are doing. So, you know, I think that's just the way pitching is going, and you won't find, you know, we talked to Matt Manning, he wasn't super into analytics and stuff, but when you're sitting there talking to the number one pick in the draft, you're going to listen because there's cachet that comes with that pick, and I'm certain that he's rubbing off a little bit on that.
Yep. All right, listen, gentlemen, we've run quite long. I can't thank you enough. I'd probably like to, when we get close to draft time, maybe we can reconvene the four of us and have a little discussion, see how some of these observations have held up over the course of the spring baseball season, see where the Tigers are at, and we can, you know, see if we can come to a consensus of who we think the Tigers' number one draft pick will be. I just want to let everybody know we'll start trying to do podcasts, you know, at least twice a month. I have a lot of great guests lined up. We're going to talk a lot about the technology in baseball. We're going to talk a lot more about new age ways teams are being built, and specifically, we're going to try to see if we can't get the Tigers to continue to come into the modern era of team building. God knows they won 47 games last year. They should be open-minded to everything. I'd like to thank you guys for taking time tonight. Brian, thank you.
For sure.
Harris, really appreciate you taking time and standing outside in a winter coat.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Chris, you're my man always, and thanks for holding down the fort.
No, absolutely. I mean, if anybody wants to promote anything or tell people where they can be reached, if they want to be reached, that now's a good time.
Brian?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at @B_Sikowski_PG, and all of my articles and stuff go through that account, so easy enough.
Harris, I know you're going to be writing a Tiger Minor League report. Where can we find you on Twitter?
I will. I got something on Bryant Packard coming up. Hopefully I'll be out within a week. And then after that, I'm going to do some college preview stuff since, as you said, the Tigers have four of the first 73 picks. So I'm going to give two All-America teams there, and hopefully some of the guys on those teams will be Tigers in 5 or 6 short months.
Yeah, that would be exciting. Chris, SRD is... Yep. Taping when?
We'll be doing SRD tomorrow night, and then I think we're going to be doing Marching Orders with James Shipman on Friday. So we got multiple podcasts coming. I've got an article coming up the beginning of the TMLR Toolshed series where I'm looking at the best hit tools in the Tiger system. So, yeah, we got a lot of stuff coming up. You know, things are getting ramped up. I'm sure JUCO season's starting soon for Brian.
Amen.
So, yeah, things are going to really start coming in here quickly. So I appreciate everybody listening to this and checking us out at TigersMinorLeagueReport.com. And, yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
All right, everybody. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Boys.